5,000 telegrams flooded Venice within 24 hours of Richard Wagner's death in 1883. Memorial concerts erupted across continents. His funeral procession along the Grand Canal featured Siegfried's funeral music, as if the gods themselves were mourning. This wasn't just grief for a composer. It was something stranger, more unsettling. Wagner had become a cultural force field, bending art, politics, and identity around his gravitational pull. Thomas Mann called him the most volcanically controversial artist who ever lived. Even if you've never stepped inside an opera house, you know Wagner. The Ride of the Valkyries thundering through Apocalypse Now, the bridal chorus at countless weddings. His music has been claimed by revolutionaries and fascists, feminists and mystics, gay rights activists and anti-Semites. How does one man's art become a mirror for an entire civilization's contradictions? Wagner never wanted to be just a composer. He wrote his own libretti, designed his own theater at Bayreuth, and invented Gesamtkunstwerk, the total artwork fusing music, drama, poetry, and visual spectacle. His four-opera Ring cycle, begun during the revolutionary fervor of 1848, emerged as a radical critique of industrial capitalism disguised as Norse mythology. The Rheingold represented wealth's corrupting power, the gods symbolized a doomed aristocracy. Wotan's devastating monologue in Die Walküre, where he realizes his own powerlessness, came from Wagner's encounter with Schopenhauer's bleak philosophy. A sense of shock beyond anything previously experienced, he wrote. The 1876 Bayreuth premiere attracted emperors and kaisers, but philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche found it overrun by bored, unmusical aristocrats buying Wagner beer mugs. Wagner himself fell into dejection, having lost money and feeling his vision had been commercialized. R is very sad, says he wishes he could die, his wife Cosima recorded. Even Nietzsche's later attacks on Wagner as a desperate charlatan couldn't hide his continued adoration, what Thomas Mann called panegyrics with the sign reversed. Charles Baudelaire attended Wagner's 1860 Paris concerts and experienced something close to religious ecstasy. The Lohengrin Prelude made him feel released from the bonds of gravity, an ecstasy composed of knowledge and joy. This wasn't mere appreciation, it was addiction. Baudelaire connected Wagner's goal of reunifying the arts with his own synesthetic command of the senses. The 1861 Tannhäuser scandal at the Paris Opera became a cultural watershed. Aristocratic jockey club members disrupted performances with hunting whistles and orchestrated catcalls. Wagner withdrew the opera after three chaotic nights, but the controversy only enhanced his reputation among artistic progressives who saw him as a martyr to bourgeois philistinism. By the 1880s, a new literary vanguard had emerged, Verlaine, Mallarmé, Rimbaud, exploring uncanny images and dreams through dense, impenetrable language. These symbolists rejected objective reality, seeking hidden truths beyond appearance. Painter Henri Fontaine-Latour created misty, dreamlike canvases, translating musical experience into visual form. Vincent van Gogh explicitly associated Wagner with explosions of color, writing that he sought to make of painting what the music of Berlioz and Wagner has been before us. Victorian Britain initially resisted Wagner critic. J.W. Davison called him a desperate charlatan, and his anti-Jewish views troubled many. Yet by the early 1880s, Wagnerism had become phenomenal, attracting the Prince of Wales and William Gladstone to the Ring. The Pre-Raphaelites embraced Wagnerian themes, though William Morris denounced bringing such material under the gaslights of an opera. In America, Wagner reached audiences through the Germania Musical Society, radical musicians who fled Berlin after 1848. German-born conductor Theodor Thomas became his chief advocate. His 1872 Ride of the Valkyries made audiences leap on chairs shouting. Architect Louis Sullivan transformed into an ardent Wagnerite after hearing Thomas conduct Lohengrin, recognized in Wagner a mighty personality, a great free spirit. Sullivan's Auditorium offered a democratic alternative to the Met's elite boxes, using egalitarian fan-shaped seating inspired by the Festspielhaus. Wagner's vision of art transcending class barriers resonated with American democratic ideals, even as his own politics grew reactionary. Wagner's 1850 essay, Jewishness in Music, transformed religious prejudice into racial anti-Semitism, declaring Jews cultural parasites incapable of authentic art. He described Jewish speech as hissing, shrill, buzzing, grunting, and claimed to hear these qualities in Felix Mendelssohn's music. Wagner introduced Verjudung, Jewification of modern art, concluding with the suggestion that Jews needed redemption through Untergang, a term meaning either cultural assimilation or physical destruction. Though Wagner's operas contain no explicitly Jewish characters, scholars identify anti-Semitic caricatures in Alberic, the greedy dwarf, Mime, the scheming craftsman, and Beckmesser, the pedantic critic. His 1848 Ring sketch describes Nibelung dwarves burrowing with shifty, restless activity like worms in a dead body, language mirroring his pamphlet's description of Jews. The paradox of Jewish Wagnerites found its most prominent example in Hermann Levi, the Jewish conductor Wagner selected to premiere Parsifal in 1882. Despite Wagner suggesting Levi be baptized, a deeply insulting proposition Levi rejected, Levi maintained faith in Wagner's genius, calling him the best and noblest person. This cognitive dissonance exemplified the complicated relationship many Jewish musicians maintained with Wagner's art, attempting to separate the composer's repugnant views from his revolutionary achievements, a separation history would prove impossible. On February 13, 1933, 50 years after Wagner's death, Thomas Mann delivered Sorrows and Grandeur of Richard Wagner in Amsterdam, 2 weeks after Hitler became Reich's Chancellor. Mann challenged Nazi appropriation, arguing Wagner belonged to the party of reform, change, liberation, boldly calling him someone who would most certainly be called a culture Bolshevist today. Hitler's obsession made Wagner ceremonially central to the regime, with swastikas replacing the composer's autobiography with Mein Kampf in Bayreuth bookstores. Yet Wagner's works troubled Nazi leadership. Parsifal particularly vexed Goebbels, Rosenberg, and Himmler, who found its compassionate message incompatible with Nazi ideology. Hitler disagreed, wanting Parsifal performed against his own party. After the war, Wagner found new life in cinema. The helicopter assault scored to Ride of the Valkyries in Apocalypse Now transformed the music into shorthand for military aggression. Despite Coppola's intended critique, the scene ironically became an anthem of American military might. Black Hawk helicopters blared it during the 1983 Grenada invasion, and PSYOPs units played it in both Gulf Wars. Wagner's music had become the soundtrack for the very violence his Ring cycle warned against. Wagner holds up a magnifying mirror to humanity itself. His music contains our contradictions, transcendent beauty and destructive impulses, yearning for redemption and attraction to power. He inspired feminists and fascists, mystics and militarists alike. His anti-Semitism poisoned his legacy irreparably, yet his musical innovations transformed Western art forever. Virginia Woolf found mystical communion in his work. Willa Cather discovered ways to articulate American landscapes and female artistic awakening. Modernists from Conrad to Joyce absorbed his techniques while rejecting his aesthetics. Today, Wagner remains both celebrated and condemned. What we hate in him, we hate in ourselves. What we love in ourselves also. His influence is inescapable. The question is whether we can face what his mirror reveals, our capacity for both beauty and brutality. Can we hold both truths simultaneously? Wagner challenges us not to resolve this contradiction, but to live with it consciously.